Hello and welcome to the Zero to Finals podcast. My name is Tom, and in this episode, I'm going to be talking to you about type 1 diabetes in children. And if you want to follow along with written notes on this topic, you can follow along at zerotofinals.com in the pediatric endocrinology section or in the endocrinology section of the Zero to Finals pediatrics book. So let's get straight into it. Type 1 diabetes mellitus is a disease where the pancreas stops being able to produce insulin. What causes the pancreas to stop producing insulin is unclear, and there may be a genetic component, or it may be triggered by certain viruses, such as the Coxsackie B virus and enterovirus. When the pancreas is not producing insulin, the cells of the body cannot take glucose from the blood and use it as fuel. And insulin acts like a key that lets glucose into the cell. Therefore, when there's no insulin, the cells think there is no glucose in the blood and the body is being fasted. The cells cannot use glucose, so the level of glucose in the blood keeps rising, and this causes hyperglycemia, or a high glucose level in the blood. Let's go through some basic physiology so that you know about blood glucose regulation. Eating carbohydrates causes a rise in blood glucose or blood sugar levels. As the body uses carbohydrates for energy, there is a fall in blood glucose levels. The body ideally wants to keep the blood glucose concentration between 4.4 and 6.1 millimoles per litre. Insulin is a hormone produced by the pancreas that reduces blood sugar levels. And insulin is produced by the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas. And it's an anabolic hormone, meaning a building hormone. And it's always present in small amounts, but it increases when the blood sugar levels rise. Insulin reduces blood sugar in two ways. Firstly, it causes cells to absorb glucose from the blood and use it as fuel. And secondly, it causes muscle and liver cells to absorb glucose from the blood and store it as glycogen. Insulin is essential for letting cells take glucose out of the blood and use it as fuel. Without insulin, cells cannot take up and use glucose in the blood. Glucagon is a hormone that increases blood sugar levels. It's produced by the alpha cells in the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas. And it's a catabolic hormone, meaning a breakdown hormone. It's released in response to low blood sugar levels and stress, and it tells the liver to break down stored glycogen into glucose. This process is called glycogenolysis. It also tells the liver to convert proteins and fats into glucose, and this process is called gluconeogenesis. Ketogenesis occurs when there's insufficient supply of glucose and glycogen stores have been exhausted, such as in prolonged fasting. The liver takes fatty acids and converts them into ketones. And ketones are water-soluble fatty acids that can be used as fuel. Ketones can cross the blood-brain barrier and be used by the brain as fuel. Producing ketones is normal and it's not harmful in healthy patients when they're under fasting conditions, or when they're on a very low carbohydrate, high fat diet. People in ketosis have a characteristic acetone smell to their breath. Let's talk about the presentation of type 1 diabetes. About 25 to 50% of new type 1 diabetic children present in diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA. And this is the result of a situation where the pancreas can no longer produce enough insulin to maintain basic blood glucose regulation. The remaining pediatric patients present with a classic triad of symptoms of hyperglycemia, and this triad is polyuria, or excessive urine, polydipsia, or excessive thirst, and weight loss, mostly because of the dehydration. Less typical presentations include secondary enuresis, which is bedwetting in a previously dry child, and recurrent infections. Symptoms are usually present 1 to 6 weeks prior to developing DKA. However, this can vary significantly. Let's talk about a new diagnosis. When a new diagnosis is established, the following blood test should be taken to exclude other associated pathology and get a baseline idea of the child's overall health. Baseline bloods, including full blood count, renal profile, and a formal laboratory glucose are useful. Blood cultures should be performed in patients with suspected infection, for example, if they present with a fever. A HbA1c can be used to get a picture of the blood glucose over the last 3 months, and it gives an idea of how long they've been diabetic prior to presenting. Thyroid function tests and thyroid peroxidase antibodies, or anti-TPO antibodies, to test for associated autoimmune thyroid disease should be taken. Tissue transglutaminase antibodies, or anti-TTG, should be checked to test for associated celiac disease. And also insulin antibodies, anti-GAD antibodies, and islet cell antibodies can be used to test for antibodies associated with destruction of the pancreas and the development of type 1 diabetes. Let's talk about long-term management. Patient and family education is essential. Monitoring and treatment is relatively complex, and it's a lifelong condition that requires the patient to be fully engaged and understand their condition. Patients need to take responsibility for their diabetes and become expert patients as they get older and mature and become independent from their family. Management involves the following components: subcutaneous insulin regimes to replace the missing insulin, monitoring of dietary carbohydrate intake, monitoring of blood sugar levels on waking, with each meal and before bed, and monitoring for and managing complications both in the short and long term. And we'll go through each one of these in more detail. Let's start with insulin. Insulin is usually prescribed as a combination of background long-acting insulin given once a day and a short-acting insulin injected 30 minutes before the intake of carbohydrates, for example at meals. Alternatively, insulin can be administered by insulin pumps, and insulin regimes are initiated by a diabetic specialist. Injecting insulin into the same spot repeatedly can cause a condition called lipodystrophy, which is where the subcutaneous fat hardens and prevents normal absorption of the insulin when further doses are injected into the same site. For this reason, patients should cycle their insulin injection sites. If a patient is not responding to insulin as you would expect, ask where they inject and check for lipodystrophy in that area. Let's talk about basal bolus regimes. When first diagnosed, patients are usually initiated on a basal bolus regime by a specialist in diabetes. The basal part refers to the injection of long-acting insulin, such as Lantus, which is typically in the evening. This basal part gives a constant background insulin throughout the day. And the bolus part refers to an injection of short-acting insulin, such as ActRapid, usually 3 times a day before meals. And this is also injected every time the patient has a snack, according to the number of the carbohydrates in the snack or the meal. Next, let's talk about insulin pumps. Insulin pumps are small devices that continuously infuse insulin subcutaneously at different rates to control blood sugar levels. They're an alternative to the basal bolus regime. The pump pushes insulin through a small plastic tube called a cannula that's inserted under the skin, and the cannula is replaced every 2 to 3 days, and the insertion sites are rotated to prevent lipodystrophy and absorption issues. To qualify for an insulin pump funded by the NHS, the child needs to be over 12 and have difficulty controlling their HbA1c, and local criteria will also apply. The advantages of an insulin pump are better blood sugar control, more flexibility with eating, and less injections. The disadvantages are that there can be difficulties learning to use the pump. It has to be attached at all times, there can be blockages in the infusion sets, and there's a small risk of infection. There are 2 types of insulin pumps, a tethered pump and a patch pump. Tethered pumps are devices that have replaceable infusion sets and insulin, and they're usually attached to the patient's belt or around the waist with a tube that connects from the pump to the insertion site. The controls for the infusion are on the pump itself, and accessed around the patient's waist or around their belt. Patch pumps sit directly on the skin without any visible tubes, And when they run out of insulin, the entire patch pump is disposed of and a new pump is attached. And patch pumps are usually controlled by a separate remote. Let's talk about short-term complications. The short-term complications relate to immediate insulin and blood glucose management, and they can be hypoglycemia, which is a low blood sugar level, or hyperglycemia, and potentially diabetic ketoacidosis. So firstly, talking about hypoglycemia. Hypoglycemia is a low blood sugar level, and in diabetes, this is caused by too much insulin, not enough carbohydrates, or not processing the carbohydrates properly. For example, if there's malabsorption, diarrhea, vomiting, or sepsis. Most patients are aware when they're hypoglycemic by their symptoms. However, some patients can be unaware until they're severely hypoglycemic. Typical symptoms of hypoglycemia are hunger, tremor, sweating, irritability, dizziness, and pallor. More severe hypoglycemia will lead to reduced consciousness, coma, and death unless it's treated. Hypoglycemia needs to be treated with a combination of rapid-acting glucose, such as Lucozade, and slower-acting carbohydrates, such as biscuits or toast, in order to maintain the blood sugar level when the rapid-acting glucose is used up. Options for treating severe hypoglycemia, where there's impairment of consciousness, seizures, or coma, and oral glucose would not be safe, are to use IV dextrose and intramuscular glucagon. Intramuscular glucagon does not require a cannula. If the patient has a cannula, then a 10% dextrose solution can be given according to local protocols. For example, a 2 mL per kilogram bolus followed by a 5 mL per kilo per hour infusion. Other causes of hypoglycemia include hypothyroidism, glycogen storage disorders, growth hormone deficiency, liver cirrhosis, alcohol, and fatty acid oxidation defects such as MCAD. Nocturnal hypoglycemia is a common complication, and the child may be very sweaty at nighttime, and the morning blood glucose levels may be raised. Diagnosis of nocturnal hypoglycemia can be made by continuous glucose monitoring, and it can be treated by altering the bolus insulin regimes and snacks at bedtime. Let's talk about hyperglycemia. Patients that are hyperglycemic but not in DKA may require their insulin dose to be increased. Patients will get to know their own individual response to insulin and be able to administer a dose to correct any hyperglycemia. For example, they may learn that 1 unit of NovoRapid reduces their sugar level by around 4 millimoles per liter. Be conscious that it can take several hours for this insulin to take effect, and repeating the dose too early could lead to hypoglycemia. When they meet the criteria for diabetic ketoacidosis, they need admission for inpatient management. Let's talk about the long-term complications. Chronic exposure to hyperglycemia, or a high sugar level, causes damage to the endothelial cells of blood vessels, and this leads to leaky, malfunctioning vessels that are unable to regenerate. High levels of sugar in the blood also cause suppression of the immune system and creates an optimal environment for infectious organisms to thrive. There's a few macrovascular complications relating to large blood vessels, and these are coronary artery disease, which is a major cause of death in diabetics, peripheral ischemia, which causes poor healing, ulcers, and the typical diabetic foot, strokes, and high blood pressure or hypertension. There are a few microvascular complications relating to very small blood vessels, and these are peripheral neuropathy, retinopathy in the back of the eye, and kidney disease, particularly glomerulosclerosis. And there's some infection-related complications, such as urinary tract infections, pneumonia, skin and soft tissue infections, particularly in the feet, and fungal infections, particularly oral or vaginal candidiasis, or thrush. Let's talk about monitoring the diabetes. First, we need to talk about HbA1c. When we check the HbA1c, we are counting the glycated hemoglobin, And this is how much glucose is attached to the hemoglobin molecules inside red blood cells. And this is considered to reflect the average blood glucose level over the past 3 months. Because red blood cells have a lifespan of around 3 to 4 months. We measure the HbA1c every 3 to 6 months to track the average blood sugar level over time and determine how effective our interventions are and how well controlled the diabetes is. It requires a blood sample sent to the lab, usually in a red EDTA bottle. We also measure the capillary blood glucose level. The capillary blood glucose is measured using a little machine called a glucose meter, and it gives an immediate reading of how high the blood sugar level is. Patients with type 1 and type 2 diabetes rely on these machines to self-monitor their glucose level on a day-to-day and hour-by-hour basis. There's also something called flash glucose monitoring, and an example of how this can be measured is with the Freestyle Libre system. And this uses a sensor on the skin that measures the glucose level of the interstitial fluid in the subcutaneous tissue. And there's a 5-minute lag of the glucose level in the interstitial fluid compared to the glucose level in the blood. The sensor records the glucose readings at short intervals, so you get a really good impression of what the glucose level is doing over time. The user needs to use a reader in order to swipe over the sensor, and the reader shows the sugar level readings. Sensors need to be replaced every 2 weeks for the Freestyle Libre system. It's quite expensive, and the NHS funding is only available in certain areas at present. And remember, there's a 5-minute delay behind the blood sugar levels, which means it's necessary to test the capillary blood glucose level by finger prick testing if hypoglycemia is being suspected. So thanks for listening to this episode on type 1 diabetes. A big thank you as always to Harry Watchman for perfectly editing the podcast. I hope you tune in for the next episode, which will be on diabetic ketoacidosis.